glass for fear of being hooted and followed. Behold me, already a redresser of wrongs. In order to be a regular paladin, I only wanted a lady. I had two. From time to time I went to see my father in Nyon, a little town in the Vaud country, where he had settled. He was very much liked, and his son felt the effects of his popularity. During the short time I stayed with him, friends vied with each other in making me welcome. A certain Madame de Voulson, especially, bestowed 1,000 caresses upon me, and to crown all, her daughter took me for her lover. It is easy to understand the meaning of a lover 11 years old, for a girl of 22, but all these roguish young women are so ready to put little puppets in front in order to hide larger ones, or to tempt them with the idea of an amusement which they know how to render attractive. As for myself, I saw no incongruity between us, and took the matter seriously. I abandoned myself with all my heart, or rather with all my head, for it was only in that part of me that I was in love, although madly. And my transports, excitement and frenzy, produced scenes enough to make anyone split his sides with laughing. I am acquainted with two very distinct and very real kinds of love, which have scarcely anything in common, although both are very fervent, and which both differ from tender friendship. The whole course of my life has been divided between these two kinds of love, essentially so different, and I have even felt them both at the same time. For instance, at the time of which I am speaking, while I took possession of Mademoiselle de Voulson so openly and so tyrannically that I could not endure that any man should approach her, I had several meetings, brief but lively, with a certain little Mademoiselle Goton, in which she deigned to play the schoolmistress, and that was all. But this all, which was really all for me, seemed to me the height of happiness, and already feeling the value of the mystery, although I only knew how to make use of it as a child, I paid Mademoiselle de Voulson, who had scarcely any suspicion of it, in the same coin, for the assiduity with which she made use of me to conceal other amours. But, to my great regret, my secret was discovered, or not so well kept on the part of my little schoolmistress as on my own. We were soon separated, and some time afterwards, on my return to Geneva, while passing through Coutances, I heard some little girls cry in an undertone, "Goton tic-tac Rousseau!" This little Mademoiselle Goton was really a singular person. Without being pretty, she had a face which was not easy to forget, and which I still recall to mind, often too tenderly for an old fool. Neither her form, nor her manner, nor, above all, her eyes, were in keeping with her age. She had a proud and commanding air, which suited her part admirably, and which in fact had suggested the first idea of it to us. But the oddest thing about her was a mixture of impudence and reserve, which it was difficult to comprehend. She took the greatest liberties with me, but had never allowed me to take any with her. She treated me just like a child, which makes me believe either that she was no longer one herself, or that, on the contrary, she was still childish enough to see nothing but an amusement in the danger to which she exposed herself. I belonged entirely, so to say, to each of these two persons, and so completely that, when I was with one, I never thought of the other. In other respects, there was not the slightest similarity between the feelings with which they inspired me. I could have spent all my life with Mademoiselle de Voulson without ever thinking of leaving her. But when I approached her, my joy was tranquil and free from emotion. I loved her above all in fashionable society. The witty sallies, railleries, and even the petty jealousies attracted and interested me. I felt a pride and glory in the marks of preference she bestowed upon me in the presence of grown-up rivals, whom she appeared to treat with disdain. I was tormented, but I loved the torment. The applause, encouragement, and laughter warmed and inspirited me. I had fits of passion and broke out into audacious sallies. In society I was transported with love. In a tête-à-tête, I should have been constrained, cold, perhaps wearied. However, I felt a real tenderness for her. I suffered when she was ill. I would have given my own health to restore her own. And observe, I knew very well from experience the meaning of illness and health. When absent from her, I thought of her and missed her. When I was by her side, her caresses reached my heart, not my senses. I was intimate with her with impunity. My imagination demanded no more than she granted. Yet I could not have endured to see her do even as much for others. I loved her as a brother, but I was as jealous of her as a lover. I should have been as jealous of Mademoiselle Gothon as a Turk, a madman, or a tiger, if I had once imagined that she could accord the same treatment to another as to myself. For even that was a favour which I had to ask on my knees. I approached Mademoiselle de Vulson with lively pleasure, but without emotion. Whereas, if I only saw Mademoiselle Gothon, I saw nothing else. All my senses were bewildered. With the former, I was familiar without familiarity. While, on the contrary, in the presence of the latter, I was as bashful as I was excited, even in the midst of our greatest familiarities. I believe that if I had remained with her long, I should have died. The throbbings of my heart would have suffocated me. I was equally afraid of displeasing either, but I was more attentive to the one and more obedient to the other. Nothing in the world would have made me annoy Mademoiselle de Vulson, but if Mademoiselle Gothon had ordered me to throw myself into the flames, I believe I should have obeyed her immediately. My amour, or rather my meetings, with the latter, continued only for a short time, happily for both of us. Although my relations with Mademoiselle de Vulson had not the same danger, they were not without their catastrophe, after they had lasted a little longer. The end of all such connections should always be somewhat romantic and furnish occasion for exclamations of sorrow. Although my connection with Mademoiselle de Vulson was less lively, it was perhaps closer. We never separated without tears. And it is remarkable into what an overwhelming void I felt myself plunged as soon as I'd left her. I could speak and think of nothing but her. My regret was genuine and lively. But I believe that, at bottom, this heroic regret was not felt altogether for her, and that, without my perceiving it, the amusements, of which she was the centre, played their part in it. To moderate the pangs of absence, we wrote letters to each other, pathetic enough to melt the heart of a stone. At last I triumphed. She could endure it no longer, and came to Geneva to see me. This time my head was completely turned. I was drunk and mad during the 2 days she remained. When she left, I wanted to throw myself in the water after her, and the air resounded with my screams. 8 days afterwards, she sent me some bonbons and gloves, which I should have considered a great compliment if I had not learnt at the same time that she was married, and that the visit with which she had been pleased to honour me was really made in order to buy her wedding dress. I will not attempt to describe my fury. It may be imagined. In my noble rage, I swore that I would never see the faithless one again, being unable to imagine a more terrible punishment for her. She did not, however, die of it, for 20 years afterwards, when on a visit to my father, while rowing with him on the lake, I asked who the ladies were whom I saw in a boat not far from ours. "What?" said my father with a smile. "Does not your heart tell you? It is your old love, Mademoiselle de Vulson, that was now Madame Christin." I started at the almost forgotten name, but I told the boatmen to change their course. Although I had a fine opportunity of avenging myself at that moment, I did not think it worthwhile to perjure myself and to renew a quarrel, 20 years old, with a woman of 40. 1723 to 1728. Thus the most valuable time of my boyhood was wasted in follies before my future career had been decided upon. After long deliberation as to the bent of my natural inclination, a profession was determined upon for which I had the least taste. I was put with Monsieur Masseron, the town clerk, in order to learn, under his tuition, the useful trade of a fee-grabber. Grappignon, a slang term for a lawyer. This nickname was extremely distasteful to me. The hope of gaining a number of crowns in a somewhat sordid business by no means flattered my pride. The occupation itself appeared to me wearisome and unendurable. The constant application, the feeling of servitude, completed my dislike, and I never entered the office without a feeling of horror, which daily increased in intensity. Monsieur Masseron, on his part, was ill satisfied with me, and treated me with contempt. He continually reproached me with my dullness and stupidity, dinning into my ears every day that my uncle had told him that I knew something, whereas, in reality, I knew nothing. That he had promised him a sharp lad and had given him a jackass. At last I was dismissed from the office in disgrace, as being utterly incapable, and Monsieur Masseron's clerks declared that I was good for nothing except to handle a file. My calling being thus settled, I was apprenticed, not, however, to a watchmaker, but to an engraver. The contempt with which I had been treated by Monsieur Masseron had made me very humble, and I obeyed without a murmur. My new master, Monsieur Ducommun, was a rough and violent young man, who in a short time succeeded in tarnishing all the brightness of my childhood, stupefying my loving and lively nature, and reducing me, in mind as well as in position, to a real state of apprenticeship. My Latin, my antiquities, my history, were all for a long time forgotten. I did not even remember that there had ever been any Romans in the world. My father, when I went to see him, no longer found in me his idol. For the ladies I was no longer the gallant Jean-Jacques, and I felt so certain myself that the Lambertiers would not have recognized their pupil in me, that I was ashamed to pay them a visit, and have never seen them since. The vilest tastes, the lowest street blackguardism, took the place of my simple amusements, and effaced even the remembrance of them. I must, in spite of a most upright training, have had a great propensity to degenerate, for the change took place with great rapidity, without the least trouble, and never did so precocious a Caesar so rapidly become a Laridon. This is the name given by La Fontaine in the fable called L'Education to degenerate dogs. Oh, combien de César deviendront Laridon! The trade in itself was not disagreeable to me. I had a decided taste for drawing. The handling of a graving tool amused me. And as the claims upon the skill of a watchmaker's engraver were limited, I hoped to attain perfection. I should perhaps have done so, had not my master's brutality and excessive restraint disgusted me with my work. I stole some of my working hours to devote to similar occupations, but which had for me the charm of freedom. I engraved medals for an order of knighthood for myself and my companions. My master surprised me at this contraband occupation and gave me a sound thrashing, declaring that I was training for a coiner, because our medals bore the arms of the Republic. I can swear that I had no idea at all of bad, and only a very faint one of good, money. I knew better how the Roman ass was made than our 3 sous pieces. My master's tyranny at length made the work, of which I should have been very fond, altogether unbearable, and filled me with vices which I should otherwise have hated, such as lying, idleness, and thieving. The recollection of the alteration produced in me by that period of my life has taught me, better than anything else, the difference between filial dependence and abject servitude. Naturally shy and timid, no fault was more foreign to my disposition than impudence, but I had enjoyed an honourable liberty, which hitherto had only been gradually restrained, and at length disappeared altogether. I was bold with my father, unrestrained with Monsieur Lambertier, and modest with my uncle. I became timid with my master, and from that moment I was a lost child. Accustomed to perfect equality in my intercourse with my superiors, knowing no pleasure which was not within my reach, seeing no dish of which I could not have a share, having no desire which I could not have openly expressed, and carrying my heart upon my lips, it is easy to judge what I was bound to become in a house in which I did not venture to open my mouth, where I was obliged to leave the table before the meal was half over, and the room as soon as I had nothing more to do there, where, incessantly fettered to my work, I saw only objects of enjoyment for others and of privation for myself, where the sight of the liberty enjoyed by my master and companions increased the weight of my servitude, where, in disputes about matters as to which I was best informed, I did not venture to open my mouth, where, in short, everything that I saw became for my heart an object of longing, simply because I was deprived of all. From that time my ease of manner, my gaiety, the happy expressions which, in former times, when I had done something wrong, had gained me immunity from punishment, all were gone. I cannot help laughing when I remember how, one evening at my father's house, having been sent to bed without any supper for some piece of roguery, I passed through the kitchen with my melancholy piece of bread, and seeing the joint turning on the spit, sniffed at it. All the household was standing round the hearth, and in passing I was obliged to say good night to everybody. When I'd gone the round, I winked at the joint, which looked so nice and smelt so good, and could not help bowing to it as well, and saying in a mournful voice, "Good night, roast beef." This naive sally amused them so much that they made me stop to supper. Perhaps it might have had the same effect with my master, but I am sure that it would never have occurred to me, and that I should not have had the courage to say it in his presence. In this manner I learnt to covet in silence, to dissemble, to lie, and lastly to steal, an idea which up to that time had never even entered my mind, and of which, since then, I have never been able to cure myself completely. Covetousness and weakness always lead in that direction. This explains why all servants are rogues, and why all apprentices ought to be. But the latter, in a peaceful state of equality, where all that they see is within their reach, lose, as they grow up, this disgraceful propensity. Not having had the same advantages, I have not been able to reap the same benefits. It is nearly always good, but badly directed principles, that make a child take the first step towards evil. In spite of continual privations and temptations, I had been more than a year with my master, without being able to make up my mind to take anything, even eatables. My first theft was a matter of obliging someone else, but it opened the door to others, the motive of which was not so praiseworthy. My master had a journeyman, named Monsieur Verrat, whose house was in the neighbourhood, and had a garden some way off which produced very fine asparagus. Monsieur Verrat, who was not too well supplied with money, conceived the idea of stealing some of his mother's young asparagus and selling it in order to provide himself with two or three good breakfasts. As he was unwilling to run the risk himself, and was not very active, he selected me for the expedition. After some preliminary cajoleries, which the more easily succeeded with me as I did not see their aim, he proposed it to me as an idea that had struck him on the spur of the moment. I strongly opposed it. He persisted. I have never been able to resist flattery. I gave in. I went every morning to gather a crop of the finest asparagus and carried it to the Moulin, where some good woman, who saw that I had just stolen it, told me so to my face, in order to get it cheaper. In my fright I took whatever she chose to offer me, and took it to Verrat. The amount was immediately converted into a breakfast, of which I was the purveyor, and which he shared with another companion. I myself was quite satisfied with a few scraps, and never even touched their wine. This little arrangement continued several days, without its even occurring to me to rob the robber, and to levy my tithe of the proceeds of Monsieur Verrat's asparagus. I performed my part in the transaction with the greatest loyalty. My only motive was to please him who prompted me to carry it out. And yet, if I had been caught, What blows, abuse, and cruel treatment should I have had to endure, while the wretch, who would have been sure to give me the lie, would have been believed on his word, and I should have suffered double punishment for having had the impudence to accuse him, seeing that he was a journeyman while I was only an apprentice. So true it is that in every condition of life the strong man who is guilty saves himself at the expense of the innocent who is weak. In this manner I learned that stealing was not so terrible a thing as I had imagined, and I soon knew how to make such good use of my discovery that nothing I desired, if it was within my reach, was safe from me. I was not absolutely ill-fed, and abstinence was only rendered difficult to me from seeing that my master observed it so ill himself. The custom of sending young people from the table when the most appetizing dishes are brought on appears to me admirably adapted to make them gluttons as well as thieves. In a short time I became both the one and the other, and as a rule I came off very well, occasionally, when I was caught, very badly. I shudder, and at the same time laugh, when I remember an apple hunt which cost me dear. These apples were at the bottom of a storeroom, which was lighted from the kitchen by means of a high grating. One day, when I was alone in the house, I climbed upon the kneading trough, in order to look at the precious fruit in the garden of the Hesperides, which was out of my reach. I went to fetch the spit to see if I could touch the apples. It was too short. To make it longer, I tied onto it another little spit, which was used for small game, for my master was very fond of sport. I thrust several times, without success. At last, to my great delight, I felt that I had secured an apple. I pulled very gently. The apple was close to the grating. I was ready to catch hold of it. But who can describe my grief when I found that it was too large to pass through the bars? How many expedients I tried to get it through. I had to find supports to keep the spit in its place, a knife long enough to divide the apple, a lath to hold it up. At last I managed to divide it, and hoped to be able to pull the pieces towards me one after the other. But no sooner were they separated than they both fell into the storeroom. Compassionate reader, share my affliction. I by no means lost courage, but I had lost considerable time. I was afraid of being surprised. I put off a more lucky attempt till the following day, and returned to my work as quietly as if I had done nothing, without thinking of the two tell-tale witnesses in the storeroom. The next day, finding the opportunity favourable, I made a fresh attempt. I climbed upon my stool, lengthened the spit, adjusted it, and was ready to make a lunge, but unfortunately the dragon was not asleep. All at once the door of the storeroom opened, my master came out, folded his arms, looked at me, and said, "Courage!" The pen falls from my hand. In consequence of continuous ill-treatment, I soon became less sensitive to it, and regarded it as a kind of compensation for theft, which gave me the right to continue the latter. Instead of looking back and considering the punishment, I looked forward and thought of revenge. I considered that if I were beaten as a rogue, I was entitled to behave like one. I found that stealing and a flogging went together, and constituted a sort of bargain, and that if I performed my part, I could safely leave my master to carry out his own. With this idea I began to steal more quietly than before. I said to myself, "What will be the result? I shall be flogged. Never mind, I am made to be flogged." I am fond of eating, but am not greedy. I am sensual, but not a gourmand. Too many other tastes prevent that. I have never troubled myself about my food, except when my heart has been unoccupied, and that has so seldom been the case during my life that I have scarcely had time to think about dainties. For this reason I did not long confine my thievish propensities to eatables, but soon extended them to everything which tempted me. And if I did not become a regular thief, it was because I have never been much tempted by money. Leading out of the common workshop was a private room belonging to my master, the door of which I found means to open and shut without being noticed. There I laid under contribution his best tools, drawings, proofs, in fact, everything which attracted me, and which he purposely kept out of my reach. At bottom, these thefts were quite innocent, being only committed to serve him. But I was transported with joy at having these trifles in my power. I thought that I was robbing him of his talent, together with its productions. Besides, I found boxes containing gold and silver filings, little trinkets, valuables, and coins. When I had 4 or 5 sous in my pocket, I thought I was rich. And yet, far from touching anything of what I found there, I do not even remember that I ever cast longing eyes upon it. I looked upon it with more affright than pleasure. I believe that this horror of stealing money and valuables was in great part the result of my bringing up. With it were combined secret thoughts of disgrace, prison, punishment, and the gallows, which would have made me shudder if I had been tempted. Whereas my tricks only appeared to me in the light of pieces of mischief, and in fact were nothing else. They could lead to nothing but a sound flogging from my master, and I prepared myself for that beforehand. But, I repeat, I never felt sufficient longing to need to control myself. I had nothing to contend with. A single sheet of fine drawing paper tempted me more than money, enough to buy a ream of it. This singularity is connected with one of the peculiarities of my character. It has exercised such great influence upon my conduct that it is worthwhile to explain it. I am a man of very strong passions, and while I am stirred by them, nothing can equal my impetuosity. I forget all discretion, all feelings of respect, fear, and decency. I am cynical, impudent, violent, and fearless. No feeling of shame keeps me back, no danger frightens me. With the exception of the single object which occupies my thoughts, the universe is nothing to me. But all this lasts only for a moment, and the following moment plunges me into complete annihilation. In my calmer moments I am indolence and timidity itself. Everything frightens and discourages me. A fly buzzing past alarms me. A word which I have to say, a gesture which I have to make, terrifies my idleness. Fear and shame overpower me to such an extent that I would gladly hide myself from the sight of my fellow creatures. If I have to act, I do not know what to do. If I have to speak, I do not know what to say. If anyone looks at me, I am put out of countenance. When I am strongly moved, I sometimes know how to find the right words, but in ordinary conversation I can find absolutely nothing, and my condition is unbearable for the simple reason that I am obliged to speak. Add to this that none of my prevailing tastes centre in things that can be bought. I want nothing but unadulterated pleasures, and money poisons all. For instance, I am fond of the pleasures of the table, but as I cannot endure either the constraint of good society or the drunkenness of the tavern, I can only enjoy them with a friend. Alone, I cannot do so, for my imagination then occupies itself with other things, and eating affords me no pleasure. If my heated blood longs for women, my excited heart longs still more for affection. Women who could be bought for money would lose for me all their charms. I even doubt whether it would be in me to make use of them. I find it the same with all pleasures within my reach. Unless they cost me nothing, I find them insipid. I only love those enjoyments which belong to no one but the first man who knows how to enjoy them. Money has never appeared to me as valuable as it is generally considered. More than that, it has never even appeared to me particularly convenient. It is good for nothing in itself. It has to be changed before it can be enjoyed. One is obliged to buy, to bargain, to be often cheated, to pay dearly, to be badly served. I should like something which is good in quality. With my money, I am sure to get it bad. If I pay a high price for a fresh egg, it is stale. For a nice piece of fruit, it is unripe. For a girl, she is spoilt. I am fond of good wine, but where am I to get it? At a wine merchant's? Whatever I do, he is sure to poison me. If I really wish to be well served, what trouble and embarrassment it entails. I must have friends, correspondence, give commissions, write, go backwards and forwards, wait, and in the end be often deceived. What trouble with my money? My fear of it is greater than my fondness for good wine. Times without number, during my apprenticeship and afterwards, I have gone out with the intention of buying some delicacy. Coming to a pastry-cook's shop, I notice some women at the counter. I think I can already see them laughing amongst themselves at the little glutton. I go on to a fruiterer's. I eye the fine pears. Their smell tempts me. Two or three young people close by me look at me. A man who knows me is standing in front of his shop. I see a girl approaching in the distance. Is it the housemaid? My short-sightedness causes all kinds of illusions. I take all the passers-by for acquaintances. Everywhere I am intimidated, restrained by some obstacle. My desire increases with my shame, and at last I return home like a fool, consumed with longing, having in my pocket the means of satisfying it, and yet not having had the courage to buy anything. I should enter into the most insipid details if, in relating how my money was spent by myself or others, I were to describe the embarrassment, the shame, the repugnance, the inconvenience, the annoyances of all kinds which I have always experienced. In proportion as the reader, following the course of my life, becomes acquainted with my real temperament, he will understand all this without my taking the trouble to tell him. This being understood, it will be easy to comprehend one of my apparent inconsistencies, the union of an almost sordid avarice with the greatest contempt for money. It is a piece of furniture in which I find so little convenience that it never enters my mind to long for it when I have not got it, and that, when I have got it, I keep it for a long time without spending it, for want of knowing how to make use of it in a way to please myself. But if a convenient and agreeable opportunity presents itself, I make such good use of it that my purse is empty before I know it. Besides this, one need not expect to find in me that curious characteristic of misers, that of spending for the sake of ostentation. On the contrary, I spend in secret for the sake of enjoyment. Far from glorying in my expenditure, I conceal it. I feel so strongly that money is of no use to me, that I am almost ashamed to have any, still more to make use of it. If I had ever had an income sufficient to live comfortably upon, I am certain that I should never have been tempted to be a miser. I should have spent it all, without attempting to increase it. But my precarious circumstances make me careful. I worship freedom. I abhor restraint, trouble, dependence. As long as the money in my purse lasts, it assures my independence. It relieves me of the trouble of finding expedients to replenish it, a necessity which always inspired me with dread. But the fear of seeing it exhausted makes me hoard it carefully. The money which a man possesses is the instrument of freedom. That which we eagerly pursue is the instrument of slavery. Therefore, I hold fast to that which I have, and desire nothing. My disinterestedness is therefore nothing but idleness. The pleasure of possession is not worth the trouble of acquisition. In like manner, my extravagance is nothing but idleness. When the opportunity of spending agreeably presents itself, it cannot be too profitably employed. Money tempts me less than things, because between money and the possession of the desired object there is always an intermediary, whereas between the thing itself and the enjoyment of it there is none. If I see the thing, it tempts me. If I only see the means of gaining possession of it, it does not. For this reason I have committed thefts, and even now I sometimes pilfer trifles, which tempt me, and which I prefer to take rather than to ask for. But neither when a child nor a grown-up man do I ever remember to have robbed anyone of a farthing, except on one occasion, 15 years ago, when I stole 7 livres 10 sous. The incident is worth recording, for it contains a most extraordinary mixture of folly and impudence, which I should have found difficulty in believing if it concerned anyone but myself. It took place at Paris. I was walking with Monsieur de Francais in the Palais Royal about 5 o'clock. He pulled out his watch, looked at it, and said, "Let us go to the opera." I agreed. We went. He took 2 tickets for the amphitheatre, gave me one, and went on in front with the other. I followed him. He went in. Entering after him, I found the door blocked. I looked, and seeing everybody standing up, thought it would be easy to lose myself in the crowd, or at any rate to make Monsieur de Francais believe that I'd lost myself. I went out, took back my cheque, then my money, and went off, without thinking that as soon as I'd reached the door everybody had taken their seats, and that Monsieur de Francais clearly saw that I was no longer there. According to Georges Sand, in her Histoire de ma vie, Monsieur de Francais, who was her grandfather, has always absolutely denied the truth of this story. As nothing was ever more foreign to my disposition than such behaviour, I mention it in order to show that there are moments of semi-delirium during which men must not be judged by their actions. I did not exactly want to steal the money. I wanted to steal the employment of it. The less of a theft it was, the greater its disgracefulness. I should never finish these details if I were to follow all the paths along which, during my apprenticeship, I descended from the sublimity of heroism to the depths of worthlessness. And yet, although I adopted the vices of my position, I could not altogether acquire a taste for them. I wearied of the amusements of my companions. And when excessive restraint had rendered work unendurable to me, I grew tired of everything. This renewed my taste for reading, which I had for some time lost. This reading, for which I stole time from my work, became a new offence which brought new punishment upon me. The taste for it, provoked by constraint, became a passion and soon a regular madness. La Tribu, a well-known lender of books, provided me with all kinds of literature. Good or bad, all were alike to me. I had no choice, and read everything with equal avidity. I read at the work table, I read on my errands, I read in the wardrobe, and forgot myself for hours together. My head became giddy with reading. I could do nothing else. My master watched me, surprised me, beat me, took away my books. How many volumes were torn, burnt, and thrown out of the window? How many works were left in odd volumes in La Tribu's stock? When I had no more money to pay her, I gave her my shirts, neckties, and clothes. My 3 sous of pocket money were regularly taken to her every Sunday. Well, then, I shall be told, money had become necessary to me. That is true. But it was not until my passion for reading had deprived me of all activity. Completely devoted to my new hobby, I did nothing but read, and no longer stole. Here again is one of my characteristic peculiarities. In the midst of a certain attachment to any manner of life, a mere trifle distracts me, alters me, rivets my attention, and finally becomes a passion. Then everything is forgotten. I no longer think of anything except the new object which engrosses my attention. My heart beat with impatience to turn over the leaves of the new book which I had in my pocket. I pulled it out as soon as I was alone, and thought no more of rummaging my master's workroom. I can hardly believe that I should have stolen, even if I had had more expensive tastes. Limited to the present, it was not in my way to make preparations in this manner for the future. La Tribu gave me credit. The payments on account were small, and as soon as I had my book in my pocket, I forgot everything else. The money which came to me honestly passed in the same manner into the hands of this woman, and when she pressed me, nothing was easier to dispose of than my own property. It required too much foresight to steal in advance, and I was not even tempted to steal in order to pay. In consequence of quarrels, blows, and secret and ill-chosen reading, my disposition became savage and taciturn, my mind became altogether perverted, and I lived like a misanthrope. However, if my good taste did not keep me from silly and insipid books, my good fortune preserved me from such as were filthy and licentious. Not that La Tribu, a woman in all respects most accommodating, would have made any scruple about lending them to me. But in order to increase their importance, she always mentioned them to me with an air of mystery which had just the effect of making me refuse them, as much from disgust as from shame. And chance aided my modest disposition so well that I was more than 30 years old before I set eyes upon any of those dangerous books which a fine lady finds inconvenient, because they can only be read with one hand. In less than a year I exhausted La Tribu's little stock, and want of occupation during my spare time became painful to me. I had been cured of my childish and knavish propensities by my passion for reading, and even by the books I read, which, although ill-chosen and frequently bad, filled my heart with nobler sentiments than those with which my sphere of life had inspired me. Disgusted with everything that was within my reach, and feeling that everything which might have tempted me was too far removed from me, I saw nothing possible which might have flattered my heart. My excited senses had long clamoured for an enjoyment, the object of which I could not even imagine. I was as far removed from actual enjoyment as if I had been sexless, and, already fully developed and sensitive, I sometimes thought of my crazes, but saw nothing beyond them. In this strange situation my restless imagination entered upon an occupation which saved me from myself and calmed my growing sensuality. This consisted in feeding myself upon the situations which had interested me in the course of my reading, in recalling them, in varying them, in combining them, in making them so truly my own that I became one of the persons who filled my imagination, and always saw myself in the situations most agreeable to my taste. And that, finally, the fictitious state in which I succeeded in putting myself, made me forget my actual state with which I was so dissatisfied. This love of imaginary objects, and the readiness with which I occupied myself with them, ended by disgusting me with everything around me, and decided that liking for solitude which has never left me. In the sequel we shall see more than once the curious effects of this disposition, apparently so gloomy and misanthropic, but which is really due to a too affectionate, too loving, and too tender heart, which, being unable to find any in existence resembling it, is obliged to nourish itself with fancies. For the present, it is sufficient for me to have defined the origin and first cause of a propensity which has modified all my passions, and which, restraining them by means of themselves, has always made me slow to act, owing to my excessive impetuosity and desire. In this manner I reached my 16th year, restless, dissatisfied with myself and everything, without any of the tastes of my condition of life, without any of the pleasures of my age, consumed by desires of the object of which I was ignorant, weeping without any cause for tears, sighing without knowing why. In short, tenderly caressing my chimeras, since I saw nothing around me which counterbalanced them. On Sundays my fellow apprentices came to fetch me after service to go and amuse myself with them. I would gladly have escaped from them if I'd been able, but once engaged in their amusements I became more excited and went further than any of them. It was as difficult to set me going as to stop me. Such was always my disposition. During our walks outside the city, I always went further than any of them without thinking about my return, unless others thought of it for me. Twice I was caught. The gates were shut before I could get back. The next day I was treated as may be imagined. The second time I was promised such a reception if it ever happened again that I resolved not to run the risk of it. Yet this third time, so dreaded, came to pass. My watchfulness was rendered useless by a confounded Captain Minutoli, who always shut the gate at which he was on guard half an hour before the others. I was returning with two companions. About half a league from the city I heard the retreat sounded. I doubled my pace. I heard the tattoo beat and ran with all my might. I arrived out of breath and bathed in perspiration. My heart beat. From a distance I saw the soldiers at their posts. I rushed up and cried out with a voice half choked. It was too late. 20 paces from the outposts I saw the first bridge raised. I shuddered when I saw those terrible horns rising in the air. A sinister and fatal omen of the destiny which that moment was opening for me. In the first violence of my grief, I threw myself on the glacis and hit the ground. My companions, laughing at their misfortune, immediately made up their minds what to do. I did the same, but my resolution was different from theirs. On the spot I swore never to return to my master, and the next morning when they entered the city after the gates were opened, I said good-bye to them for ever, only begging them secretly to inform my cousin Bernard of the resolution I had taken, and of the place where he might be able to see me once more. After I had entered upon my apprenticeship, I saw less of him. For some time we used to meet on Sunday, but gradually each of us adopted other habits, and we saw one another less frequently. I am convinced that his mother had much to do with his change. He was a child of the upper city, enfant du haut, that is, of the upper, more fashionable part of the city, while Saint-Gervais, on the right bank of the Rhône, was the quarter inhabited by the poorer population. I, a poor apprentice, was only a child of Saint-Gervais. In spite of our relationship, there was no longer any equality between us. It was derogatory to him to associate with me. However, relations were not entirely broken off between us, and, as he was a good-natured lad, he sometimes followed the dictates of his heart instead of his mother's instructions. When he was informed of my resolution, he hastened to me, not to try and dissuade me from it, or to share it, but to lessen the inconveniences of my flight by some small presence, since my own resources could not take me very far. Amongst other things, he gave me a small sword, which had taken my fancy exceedingly, and which I carried as far as Turin, where necessity obliged me to dispose of it, and where, as the saying is, I passed it through my body. The more I have since reflected upon the manner in which he behaved towards me at this critical moment, the more I have felt convinced that he followed the instructions of his mother, and perhaps of his father, for it is inconceivable that, left to himself, he would not have made some effort to keep me back, or would not have been tempted to follow. But no, he rather encouraged me in my plan than tried to dissuade me. And when he saw me quite determined, he left me without shedding many tears. We have never corresponded or seen each other since. It is a pity. His character was essentially good. We were made to love each other. Before I abandon myself to the fatality of my lot, allow me to turn my eyes for a moment upon the destiny which, in the nature of things, would have awaited me if I had fallen into the hands of a better master. Nothing was more suitable to my disposition, or better adapted to make me happy, than the quiet and obscure lot of a respectable artisan, especially of a certain class, such as that of the engravers of Geneva. Such a position, sufficiently lucrative to afford a comfortable livelihood, but not sufficiently so to lead to fortune, would have limited my ambition for the rest of my days, and leaving me an honourable leisure to cultivate modest tastes, would have confined me within my own sphere, without offering me the means of getting out of it. My imaginative powers were rich enough to beautify all callings with their chimeras, and strong enough to transport me, so to speak, at will from one to another. So it would have been immaterial to me in what position I actually found myself. It could not have been so far from the place where I was to my first castle in the air that I could not have taken up my abode there without any difficulty. From this alone it followed that the simplest vocation, that which involved the least trouble and anxiety, that which allowed the greatest mental freedom, was the one which suited me best, and that was exactly my own. I should have passed a peaceful and quiet life, such as my disposition required, in the bosom of my religion, my country, my family, and my friends, in the monotony of a profession that suited my taste, and in a society after my own good heart. I should have been a good Christian, a good citizen, a good father of a family, a good friend, a good workman, a good man in every relation of life. I should have loved my position in life, perhaps honoured it. And having spent a life, simple indeed and obscure, but calm and serene, I should have died peacefully in the bosom of my family. Though, doubtless, soon forgotten, I should at least have been regretted as long as anyone remembered me. Instead of that, what picture am I going to draw? Let us not anticipate the sorrows of my life. I shall occupy my readers more than enough with this melancholy subject. Book 2, 1728 to 1731. However mournful the moment, when terror suggested to me the idea of flight had appeared, the moment when I carried it into execution appeared equally delightful. While still a child, to leave my country, my parents, my means of support, my resources, to give up an apprenticeship half-served without a sufficient knowledge of my trade to earn my livelihood, to abandon myself to the horrors of want, without any means of saving myself from it, to expose myself at the age of innocence and weakness to all the temptations of vice and despair, to seek, in the distance, suffering, error, snares, servitude, and death, beneath a yoke far more unbending than that which I had been unable to endure. This was what I was going to do. This was the prospect which I ought to have considered. How different was that which my fancy painted! The independence which I believed I had gained was the only feeling which moved me. Free and my own master, I believed I could do everything, attain to everything. I had only to launch myself forth, to mount and fly through the air. I entered the vast world with a feeling of security. It was to be filled with the fame of my achievements. At every step I was to find festivities, treasures, adventures, friends ready to serve me, mistresses eager to please me. I had only to show myself, to engage the attention of the whole world, and yet not the whole world. To a certain extent I could dispense with it, and did not want so much. Charming society was enough for me, without troubling myself about the rest. In my modesty I limited myself to a narrow, but delightfully select, circle, in which my sovereignty was assured. A single castle was the limit of my ambition, as the favourite of the lord and the lady, as the lover of the daughter. As the friend of the son and protector of the neighbours, I was content. I wanted no more. In the expectation of this modest future, I wandered for some days round the city, lodging with some peasants whom I knew, who all received me with greater kindness than any of the inhabitants of the city would have done. They took me in, lodged me, and fed me with too much kindness to make a merit of it. It could not be called charity. They did not bestow it with a sufficient air of superiority. Travelling and roaming about in this manner, I reached Confignon, in the district of Savoy, 2 leagues from Geneva. The name of the curé was Monsieur de Pontvert. This name, famous in the history of the Republic, arrested my attention. I was curious to see what the descendants of the Knights of the Spoon looked like. These Catholic knights, subjects of the Duke of Savoy, formed a league against the Genevese in the time of the Reformation, and were so called because they boasted of having eaten their enemies with a spoon, and carried a spoon hung round their necks. They were headed by a de Pontvert. I called upon Monsieur de Pontvert. He received me kindly, talked about the heresy of Geneva, the authority of the Holy Mother Church, and invited me to dinner. I found little to reply to arguments which ended in this manner, and I formed the opinion that curés who dined so well were at least as good as our ministers. I was certainly more learned than Monsieur de Pontvert, in spite of his birth, but I was too good a guest to be as good a theologian. And his Frangy wine, which appeared to me excellent, argued so triumphantly in his favour that I should have been ashamed to stop the mouth of so admirable a host. I therefore gave in, or at least offered no open resistance. To see the carefulness I exhibited, one would have believed me false. But that would have been a mistake. I only behaved with common courtesy, that is certain. Flattery, or rather condescension, is not always a vice. It is more often a virtue, especially in young people. The kindness with which a person treats us endears him to us. We give in to him, not in order to abuse his kindness, but to avoid annoying him or returning him evil for good. What interest had Monsieur de Pontvert in receiving me, treating me kindly, or trying to convince me? No other than my own. My young heart told me that. I was moved with gratitude and respect for the good priest. I felt my superiority. I did not wish to overwhelm him with it as the reward of his hospitality. In this attitude there was nothing hypocritical. I never thought of changing my religion, and far from familiarizing myself so rapidly with this idea, I only regarded it with a feeling of horror which was destined to keep it away from me for a long time. My only wish was to avoid annoying those who treated me kindly, with the object of converting me. I wished to cultivate their goodwill, and to leave them the hope of success, by appearing less completely armed than I really was. My fault in that respect resembled the coquetry of respectable women, who sometimes, in order to attain their object, without allowing or promising anything, know how to excite greater hopes than they mean to fulfil. Reason, pity, and regard for discipline required that, far from assisting my folly, people should have saved me from the ruin which I ran to meet and sent me back to my family. That is what every truly virtuous man would have done or attempted to do. But although Monsieur de Pontvert was a good man, he was certainly not a virtuous man. On the contrary, he was an enthusiast who knew no other virtue except worshipping images and telling his beads, a kind of missionary who could think of nothing better for the good of the faith than writing libels against the ministers of Geneva. Far from thinking of sending me back to my home, he took advantage of the desire I felt to get away from it, to make it impossible for me to return even though I should wish to do so. It was any odds that he was sending me to perish in misery, or to become a worthless scamp. But that was not what he looked at. He only saw a soul saved from heresy and restored to the church. Honest man or scamp? What did it matter, provided I went to Mass? One must not, however, believe that this way of thinking is peculiar to Catholics. It is common to all dogmatic religions in which faith, not works, is considered the principal thing. "God calls you," said Monsieur de Pontvert. "Go to Annecy. There you will find a good and charitable lady, whom the king's kindness has placed in a position to rescue other souls from the error from which she herself has been delivered." The lady in question was Madame de Warens, a new convert, who in reality had been forced by the priests to share, with the rabble which came to sell its faith, a pension of 2,000 francs, which she received from the King of Sardinia. I felt very humiliated at requiring the assistance of a good and charitable lady. I was very desirous of having my wants supplied, but not of receiving alms, and a devotee did not sound very attractive to me. However, urged by Monsieur de Pontvert, and hard pressed by hunger, and pleased at the idea of making a journey with a definite object, I made up my mind, although with some difficulty, and set out for Annecy. I could easily have reached the place in one day, but as I did not hurry, it took three. I never saw a chateau on the right or left without going in search of the adventure which I felt sure awaited me there. I did not dare to enter the chateau or knock at the door, being naturally very shy, but I sang under the window which looked most promising from outside, and after having tired out my lungs by continued efforts, was surprised that I beheld neither ladies nor maidens attracted by the beauty of my voice or the spirit of my songs. Seeing that I knew some admirable compositions which my companions had taught me, and which I sang in a manner equally admirable. At last I arrived. I saw Madame de Warenne's. That epoch of my life decided my character. I cannot bring myself to pass lightly over it. I was in the middle of my 16th year. Without being what is called a handsome lad, I was well set up. I had a pretty foot, a fine leg, an easy manner, lively features, a pretty little mouth, black hair and eyebrows, small and even sunken eyes, which, however, vigorously darted forth the fire with which my blood was kindled. Unhappily, I knew nothing of that, and it has never occurred to me during my life to think about my personal appearance.